to the most depressing scene of Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean, the podcast where we break down the movie American Splendor scene by scene, talk about Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner, and discuss the joys and challenges of being professional cartoonists. I am Josh Neufeld of joshneufeld.com.
And I'm Dean Haspiel of deanhaspiel.com.
Yes, you are. And today we are discussing scene number 20 of American Splendor, which starts at minute 52, second 19, and ends at minute 53, second 50. It starts with drawings of an enraged Joyce Brabner and ends with the real Harvey Pekar throwing up his hands saying, "I guess I fooled you." So,
drawn by Joe Sacco.
Yes.
Joe Zabel. And who else? There was a Val Myrick's cover is in there, I think.
Yeah. So there's, it starts with some panels from Joe Sacco. From, actually, what's interesting is these panels, a lot of the artwork they used for this particular montage were much more recent comics than most of the other.
In the 2000s?
This one was from 1995.
Okay.
And let's see. So the opening montage starts with three panels from Condor. That's the name of the story, from American Splendor Windfall number 2, which was a Dark Horse published issue from 1995, that were illustrated by Joe Sacco. And then there's a couple of panels, I believe, from Passport to Pimlico, illustrated by Joe Zabel. And that's from back in the day, American Splendor number 14 in 1989.
Okay.
And then they do have a quick shot of the Val Mayerick cover from American Splendor number 10, which is the first issue that features Joyce.
Okay.
So this episode, I'm going to be doing a little breakdown. And what happens here sequentially is it starts with those selected panels with some machine gun sounds underneath the ending notes of the Escape Pina Colada song.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see the real Joyce and Harvey in their faux documentary setting that we've seen before, that space in between the panels, that white space. And this is the first time that we've seen the real Joyce Brabner in the movie.
Okay.
And they are seated at a plain round table with some tea/coffee. I wonder if it's chamomile tea. And some notes and some American Splendor issues laying around. And in the background, there are other props to convey that it's a comic book store setting. There's a blown up cover of American Splendor number 3. There's some long boxes. There's a spinner rack with some mainstream comics on it. And they do not look happy to be there.
No, they don't.
Joyce is sitting with her arms folded and Harvey's leg is shaking impatiently. And it starts with Joyce talking about how she has now become a character in American Splendor. And in her opinion, she feels that Harvey tends to push the negative or the sour.
Mm.
And then the off-camera interviewer, who I assume is Sherry Springer Berman, co-director of the movie, asks Harvey if he portrays Joyce fairly. He says he does, and that he actually leaves some of the worst parts out because he wants to avoid, quote, getting his head cut off. Joyce sort of looks at him, not like she disagrees.
Right.
And then the whole time they're not looking each other in the eyes. They're both like avoiding looking each other. But
it's an incredible scene for like right off the heels of, "I'm going to go get hitched."
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
It's like, oh, fast forward to how has this marriage turned out?
Right.
So Joyce claims that Harvey leaves out the good stuff because he doesn't think that, quote, sunshine and flowers sell.
Right.
Which, of course, makes me think of the Prince song, Starfish and Coffee.
Mm.
But maybe that's just because I have to mention Prince in every episode. And then she says that he says, "Misery loves company," to which he responds, "I'm just a gloomy guy. What can I say? It's my perspective, doom and gloom."
Mm-hmm.
And then she retorts with, "Gee, I thought I was marrying someone with a sense of humor." And she says it with that like fake New York accent.
Or like, I also interpret it as like that Catskill Jewish comedian kind of.
Yes, totally.
Twist.
And twang. Then he sits there. This is the most awkward part at the end because he doesn't crack a smile. He just sits there, doesn't say anything. And then he angrily says, "Well, I guess I fooled you."
Well, angrily, but also like it's almost like they're laughing at the end. I feel like it's just
appreciate
tense.
Your your optimism.
It's not, I'm not projecting it, you know? Literally see it.
You're just watching the scene objectively, and that's what you see.
Yeah.
Well, it does end with a few final notes of the Escape Pina Colada song.
Right.
And that, to me, seems totally ironical. But
we know it as the Pina Colada song, but it is called Escape.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
Yes.
But also, when it transitions from the last scene between Toby and Harvey in the car with the White Castles, and we were contextualizing the song to be about them, the line that transitions into this scene, the actual lyric is, "You're the lady I look for."
Mm.
And so that is kind of an interesting little beat, you know, as it transitions to this real life, you know, we're about to meet the real Joyce, you know, we've already met the real Harvey before. So and I guess that's an interesting thing they do throughout the movie is that they'll introduce the character, you know, Paul Giamatti plays Harvey Pekar, Hope Davis plays...
Wait, who plays Paul Giamatti? But he's not in this scene.
No, he's not in this scene.
Oh, okay.
But previously, Josh.
Okay, right, gotcha.
Right. So, and Hope Davis portrays Joyce Brabner and Judah Friedlander portrays Toby Radloff, so on and so forth. So they'll show you like the cinematic version, let's call it, and then they'll introduce you to the real version of these people in the faux kind of documentary in between the panels setting, gutter talk, as it were, you know,
gutter talk. Ooh.
And yeah, it's jarring, and you don't know how to interpret what you've just seen when you see it. Like,
yeah,
do they hate each other? Do they loathe each other? Is that have they come to a like a resignation in their relationship?
Right.
Like, again, this is a movie that's portraying an earlier part of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they on the heels of divorce, or do they love each other so much that they can behave this way toward each other? It's very uncomfortable to watch.
Yes. All of those things kind of spring to mind, all of those questions.
And you're thinking all that and you don't know where to sit because you've just been told that he's finally going to get, you know, well, not finally get married, he's been married. But he's also been very lonely. You've seen him be lonely, and he's found someone he can relate to, you know, more so than maybe his previous wives. And so much so that he met her on the first date. They decided to get married, and a week later, he's going to get hitched, you know, at least in the movie. I don't know if that's totally true in real life as well.
I think
that's
it is.
How it worked out.
Yeah.
So that's amazing, right?
Right.
And then
that's true love, right?
Yes. So, I mean, one of my notes I wrote down is that they appeared to be tired and exhausted,
mm-hmm.
bereft of pretense. Like, they are not pretending at all to do anything, even though they have cameras and lights on them.
Right. Which is interesting because, sorry to cut you off, but back when we talked to James Urbaniak, you mentioned that when you were in film school, you talked about documentaries and how your teacher talked about how anytime a camera's on, people start performing.
It's an automatic response is to kind of behave a little more heightened or different than you naturally would be. Like, you know, nowadays, I think, you know, we have a billion pictures online of people just kind of like snoozing or just like, you know, terrible pictures that you would edit or delete. Now we're publishing all those pictures, you know, not necessarily you and I, but like the younger generation, like we'll just upload a billion pictures.
Oh, they don't like try to curate them and only show. I thought the whole thing about Facebook is that you're presenting this sort of like ideal version of yourself.
I think that's among our generation.
Uh-huh.
I think the younger generation.
They're not thinking that way.
Is not like, sure, there's posing and selfies,
mm-hmm.
but also there's like a ton of pictures where people are like untagging themselves because they're yawning or, you know, their mm-hmm. eyes are blinking or something.
So it's more like other people are putting up unflattering pictures of them and then they're trying to
although I
them.
Believe I've also seen like a trend of like people putting up terrible pictures of themselves, you know,
right,
as
when
a response.
You're young and beautiful, you can do that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. So yeah, it's a jarring scene because in one way it's one of the most memorable scenes because of how jarring it is,
yeah.
you know. And it's not jarring because there's this dramatic kind of information or reveal, a mm-hmm. narrative reveal happening. The reveal is like the movie doesn't even hold a candle next to the real people in certain ways.
Yes.
You know, and the movie's great. And it's also portraying, you know, the doom and gloom of Harvey and so on and so forth. But this is an incredible little moment because, again, the camera may be turned on them, but they don't care.
Right.
You are sharing a private moment with them,
yeah.
even though they're being interviewed.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it does make you wonder, like, maybe they were both really tired that day. Maybe they mm-hmm. had some disagreement. Maybe they are actually playing it up for the purpose of the camera.
It could be.
I mean, because you and I, obviously Harvey has passed away now, but back when he was alive and they were together, we saw Harvey and Joyce together on multiple occasions and in public presentations or whatever like this. So I remember around the time of the movie, before it came out, they came to New York City to promote a new anthology or something. Mm-hmm. And I went to a Barnes & Noble and saw them together up on the, you know, the table talking. And it was a very similar dynamic where they were, it was almost like a comedy routine, like mm-hmm. Like Milton Berle or like
sure.
George Burns. He had a famous thing with his wife, right? Where they, Gracie, where it was right. like they were fighting in public and right. that was humorous for everybody.
Right.
It almost had that quality, like they, almost a rehearsed thing where they are going to be nasty to each other,
right.
but for the benefit of the humor of the audience.
Right.
And weirdly enough, Wallace Shawn, the actor, was at that reading too, and I just happened to be standing next to him, and I introduced myself, and you know, the guy who was in My Dinner with Andre and
yep.
Princess Bride, yep. and he's a great actor, mm-hmm. just such mm-hmm. a funny personality. Mm-hmm.
I could see him portraying Picard in a movie.
Yeah, he could have, at some point he could have played Picard, yeah. but I think he was friends with them. I think he was going to go and have dinner with them afterwards.
Cool.
So
cool.
Anyway, it was a nice little moment. But I remember another time we were at a convention, it might have been all, we were all on stage together, and Joyce came up and just knitted, like
I was gonna
at the table.
I was going to remind you of that I think she did that for a little while, a few panels, mm-hmm. where she'd be knitting at the panel, and I was like, what is going on here?
Right.
And then I remember one time I took a picture of them where Harvey was sitting next to her before, maybe I wasn't on the panel, maybe they were doing a panel, and she was knitting. And before they started, you could just see them having this private little moment where, and he just kept smiling. And then she would kind of nod at him and make a smile and be knitting, looking. And it was kind of a loving moment.
Oh, that's interesting. So when the camera's not on, they're actually like adore each other.
They love each other.
Petting each other.
I mean, it is more fun to create conflict than,
right,
you know,
right.
And she even says it in the scene, like,
yeah.
or he says he doesn't betray the sun and flowers, right? Like,
right.
Because that's boring.
Right.
You know? What's more fun is to portray the conflict.
Yeah, I guess she says that that's what his perspective as a writer is.
Right.
And right. that he doesn't admit to that as much as saying, no, that's my perspective. I'm a doom and gloomy guy.
Right.
You know?
But then he kind of like, he catches himself. He's almost giggling mm-hmm. in a weird Harvey way, like where he's just catching himself and even he's realizing how absurd it is, but he has to admit it's true. You know,
right.
like, yeah, that's what I do, you know?
But that begs the question to me, like, when I think about the entirety of his work, I agree that his work does not fall into the category of happy stories,
mm-hmm.
you know, of like stories with happy endings mm-hmm. or even uplifting stories. But
I would use the word triumphant, though. I feel like he has weird mini
yeah.
micro triumphs.
Epiphanies
and epiphanies.
Exactly.
But it doesn't feel like you're winning either.
No.
You know?
No, like in the end, you maybe are back where you started or just a little bit. You have a little more understanding of insight or something, but in life you're still a schlub down at the bottom. But I still don't agree that his comics are all about doom and gloom.
No.
Like I would never say that.
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't read comics like that for that long. I mean, I might read one or two issues and be done with it. You know, we both have a mutual comics pal. I actually saw him recently at Mocha, Ivan Brunetti.
Yes.
And Ivan famously yeah. was doom and gloom. And he, to the point where he had produced three issues of a comic series called Schizo. And I think Fantagraphics published it. But I remember him telling me, I was like, because by the third issue, it was almost like not comics anymore. It was just a lettered essay with occasional drawings, right? And it was like one sentence after another of the most horrific domino of just self-loathing and hatred, right?
Yes.
And misanthropy. And I was like, Ivan, how many more issues of this can you possibly
how can you
produce?
Build on this?
And he said, oh, I have 18 in mind. And I was
oh
like, there's
gosh.
No way, number one. But number two, like, what's the payoff? He's like, oh, I'm going to commit suicide and kill myself at the end of all this. Luckily, he stopped at issue three.
Oh, my gosh. And he actually meant that he was going to commit suicide.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
And I reminded him of that recently at Mocha. And he just laughed and he nodded.
Yeah, his career has gone in a very different direction.
Yeah,
he's a teacher now and he's a theorist about comics. And he's even made a comic for kids about how to make
Toon
comics.
Books, and he does New Yorker covers sometimes. Yeah. So
I'm glad he seems to be in a better place.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, again, how many issues of that could I read? Three.
Yeah, right. And you specialized in some pretty dark perspectives in your stories.
I love horror.
And to you, Ivan Brunetti was beyond the pale.
That's right. That's right. So, like, Harvey Pekar's doom and gloom is
it's
not,
like nothing.
It's nothing.
Yeah. It's like a light shower.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that actually, if you don't mind, I wanted to ask you a question about, as a writer, what do you feel is the right balance in a story between happy and good moments versus sad and bad moments?
Well, I think I've stated before, when you're approaching and conveying a serious topic, I think what actually locks it in is levity and humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, find that moment where you can joke about it, because that's where the learning part happens. So that's where you know, it's the old adage of just like every time you're teaching and telling somebody to not do something, you have to go do it.
Mm.
You know, it's like a rebellious response.
Mm.
And it's also a way to learn. But you can throw in a joke, you might hear what's going on a little bit clearer and better, you know. But also, I love horror films. But horror films work better when there's a little bit of humor in it, you know, because it gives you that moment
to
breathe.
You always need that leavening.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So, but in terms of memoir, though, that's a different, you know, you're still crafting a story from the truth.
Right.
And we've already discussed, I think, that, you know, sometimes you have to fictionalize aspects of the truth in order to craft the story.
But it's a truism that I think is correct, that the happy stories just essentially don't work.
Like, nobody wants to read a happy story.
You need conflict.
You want a happy ending, maybe?
Right.
And I mean a happy ending, Josh.
Oh.
No. That was horrible. I'm sorry.
We are recording this in a massage parlor, so now I understand.
You don't want to read 300 pages of something that just, you walk away and go, well, that sucked. Now I hate my life.
Right.
You know, like, especially if you invest in something, you want there to be a payoff that makes you feel like, it doesn't have to be good, but it has to be like, you know, maybe an epiphany, like you said, or a moment where you can come to a moment of solace, you know?
And you want the characters, if it's a character-based story, to have gone through something that's changed them in some way and made them understand that they can overcome.
Which is
something.
Why it's really difficult to do that with fictional characters, because a lot of them, what you do is you can put them through the ringer, but you have to bring them back to point A, because that's what the character is, and that's how you perpetuate the story for 100 years. You know, this character, like superheroes,
like
and stuff.
A superhero type story,
right? Yeah. Which is why, real quick, you and I both just saw Avengers Endgame, which is, I think it's the 22nd movie of this cinematic, you know, Marvel universe that built up to something. And what was fascinating, without getting into it, no spoilers, but tonally, the first 2/3 of the movie wrestles with depression.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they earn that. And there was a sense of doom and gloom. You know, what is it like to lose when you're a hero? You know, and what do you lose, and so on and so forth. So, and in a way, I think that Harvey might have even appreciated that.
He might have liked just that first hour of
just
the movie.
Just that aspect of it. You know, he wouldn't have understood what the hell was happening because he wouldn't have seen the other movies.
Right.
But I think he would totally appreciate that, you know, because that is life. I mean, what do people talk about when they go outside after the weather? You know, they talk about their troubles usually. You know, you don't sit there talking about the awards you won like 10 years ago and, you know.
Right. You don't want to come off as a braggart.
Right. And if you do, nobody wants to talk to you.
Right. And we do know, too, and in a way, this is a callback to the last episode where Toby asked Harvey on a date to go see Revenge of the Nerds.
Right.
That I think Harvey made a pretty good point in his comics of sort of showing what his own tastes were as a appreciator of culture and of literature and film, which tended to be like literary novels and usually realist novels, which tend to be pretty downbeat, and foreign films and art films, which also tend not to focus on the positive.
What was the book he had been reading when he saw that woman in the bakery?
Jenny Gerhart.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's where he tends his own
His own aesthetics, and then his comics sort of follow a similar trajectory. Just getting back to this scene being so difficult to watch, because you almost feel like this is a moment that's so private, it shouldn't be like shaired. It's like a,
it's raw.
It's airing the dirty laundry, you know.
It feels really raw. And in fact, I would love to talk to Joyce about not only that scene and obviously the whole movie, but in particular that scene, or that when she was on camera, what was that like? What was going on?
Yeah. Well, hopefully we're going to have her on the show and
right.
maybe even on this episode
that's
to
right.
talk about that.
And I want to talk to the directors who are interviewing them and trying to pull this out of them
yeah.
because that's the part where you don't really script that. I mean, you can ask a question, but you don't know what the answer is
right,
going to be.
Right, exactly.
You know, and then what did you keep and didn't keep?
Right.
How much did they shoot?
Exactly.
You know, and what did they use for the movie and why mm-hmm. in that particular moment?
Because the moment when they place it in the movie is such a record scratch for like the way the movie seems to be moving at
right.
that moment. It's totally that,
right.
you
right.
know,
that's
like,
right.
no, this is actually a real marriage,
yes.
you know, and it's not all going to be the Pina Colada song from
that's
now on.
Right. And so I had one question for you. I know that you have collaborated with your wife, Sari, in comics, right? Didn't you co-write something, or has she
yeah,
written something that you drew?
Both, yeah.
Okay.
We co-wrote a couple of stories, and then she's written a few stories that I've illustrated.
So
as
if
well.
You could talk a little bit about that, but also my second part of the question was, have you ever been interviewed with your wife, Sari, who is a novelist, like on a panel or something, and what was the dynamic of that?
Oh, well, you know, there was some blood and scratches that needed to be cleaned up afterward. No, so we have collaborated, and actually one of the first stories that I started writing for myself back when I was starting to work with Harvey and also with David Greenberger and Duplex Planet Illustrated. So I was doing these autobiographical travel stories, and there was one of the first stories that I did was called The Cave of Fear, and it was a story about when Sari and I were in Thailand, and we actually got trapped in a not trapped, but like we were navigating this underground cave.
Spelunking, if I'm correct.
Yeah,
sort
First
of time I
spelunking.
Heard that word.
And still a strange word to say, spelunking. But yeah, we ended up in this underground cave that had been flooded, and there was one area where the cave got so tight that we actually had to swim through this underground passage to get from one side to the other.
And there was no light at that point?
Well, we had flashlights and stuff.
Could never have done it.
It was quite intimidating. The only reason that we did it was because we had already been going through the cave like a number of hours at that point, and so we would have had to go back the same way, and it would have been harder to get out than it was to get in. So we had some people with us who were brave enough to take that swim first to see how far it was.
And then come back and tell you?
Well, they yelled through. You're like,
oh, you
it's
could
okay.
hear them.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But that was quite adventurous. And anyway, the point of this story is that when I ended up writing that story,
right.
I found that there were certain descriptive elements that Sari had captured in her journal that she had written at that time that I was using as reference to help me, you know, remember what had all happened, that were so powerful that I thought it would be really cool to incorporate elements from her journal into the narrative itself to give it more flavor. And I thought it really, you know, made this story work so much better. And I probably had thought of some of the Joyce and Harvey stories together
mm-hmm.
as inspirations for doing
mm-hmm.
that, like giving myself permission.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the other things that Sari kept telling me as a fiction writer while I was working on these autobiographical travel stories that were often about these two characters, Josh and Sari,
mm-hmm.
traveling together, was she kept berating me because I wasn't adding enough conflict to our partnership. So in these other stories, not
but
that
one.
But
you've always avoided that in your work, I feel.
You mean
you
like exposing my personal...
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about that in the previous
I think we
episode.
Have talked about that. And it is difficult for me because it's not... Yeah, I guess it's some kind of like just a sense of propriety or something.
Mm.
And also maybe a fear of representing our relationship as not as happy and,
mm-hmm.
and fulfilling as I feel like it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my own hang up, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And as an artist, you need to be willing to...
And yet you appreciate it in Harvey and Joyce's work. You appreciate it, I presume, in other narratives when you see it. You don't
yeah,
like,
but
it
always
recoil
does
from it.
Freak me out. No, it does recoil. I think maybe because my parents, you know, were...
Mm.
There were a lot of fights in the house and stuff.
Mine too.
That I do... It makes me uncomfortable.
Mm.
Yeah, so I think I do get... particularly on
it's
edge.
Like you're allergic to it.
Yeah, I think there is a little
so
element
again
of that.
When we both watch this scene, we both cringe, as I think the audience is supposed
That's
to.
That's the overriding sense of
But I
cringe.
Do get joy from it, and maybe, do you derive any joy from it?
I think I'm just shocked. and so there's a little bit of like, wow, they are allowed to do that? You know? So, I mean, I enjoy that in a sort of way. Mm-hmm. Enjoy is not the right word. But I am really curious to talk to Sherry Springer Berman, Robert Pulcini, and Joyce. I do remember one funny thing was I was listening to the commentary track of the DVD of this film, and that I don't remember that anybody actually, as they were watching it together, because Joyce, Harvey, and Sherry, and Judah were all on the commentary track. I don't believe anybody said anything.
It's crickets throughout that part.
Yeah, it was sort of crickets, but except that Sherry specifically laughingly said, yeah, we laid a machine gun sound underneath those opening moments. And nobody said anything.
Nobody said anything. Just,
but that says it a lot right
that
there.
That says everything you need to say is right
exactly.
there.
Exactly.
You know, like what more? So going back to the part, like you obviously have collaborated with Sherry, and the second part of the question was, have you spoken
together?
Oh, have
we appeared together? Yeah.
And what was that, the dynamic of that?
We've done a few things like on panels, and also we visited a school together and did a presentation of our work together and have co-taught classes together and things like that. And I think they go really well. I think we try much harder to present a united front and to seem like we're on the same page and to give each other props. Mm. But, you know, the fact is, like pulling aside the curtain, that because we've been together as long as we have and we're both creative people, that we are each other's harshest critics when it comes to looking at each other's work. And we've had many disagreements, even like, you know, loud, like stomping away in anger sort of reactions to the other person's criticism of our work. And I often feel like I want that to happen because then I know I'm getting that honest response and that honest criticism. And that even though I'm a little resentful later, like then I realize, wow, actually, I'm really glad Sherry, you know, pointed out that that wasn't working or that the scene was weak or that I wrapped it up too nicely. And hopefully I think she feels the same way when I give her that kind of feedback. So that's not the kind of stuff that we share publicly.
Sure.
But it is an integral part of our creative relationship. And I would say you and I have had that sort of...
We've definitely had that.
Tough feedback with
Even
each
during
other.
This podcast, we've
No, that's that. Not true at all.
It's funny because I was trying to think myself, like with this question, like have I collaborated with... I've never been married, but with girlfriends... And I do remember, and I think you were part of that collaboration, when I dated a woman named Linda Perkins, David Greenberger.
Yes.
Who wrote Duplex Planet Illustrated, and it would have different illustrators draw stories basically of interviews with older people and old folks' homes and stuff like that. He also did music. I mean, this guy was able to turn this material into different mediums. But he had given us a two-paragraph thing where it was pretty open. It was all going to be the text in the comic. So there was no description or telling us what to draw. I think it was like basically some older guy's kind of pontification of something, right?
Yeah, it was called I Was Waiting for You, Daddy.
That's right.
And it was about a summer day in the woods with his young daughter.
Or that's how one could interpret it.
Right.
Because it was interpreted six different ways. And it was an issue of Keyhole Mini Comics. And it was you, me, Linda Perkins, Nick Nazzo,
Delmo Walters Jr.
And who was the sixth one?
Ken Nash.
And it was fascinating.
Yeah.
So in a way, not that I had collaborated with Linda, but she was a part of this process that we were all involved in.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating because there were six completely different takes on this, you know, text.
And we'll post some of those on the website.
Sure. Then... I have two more incidents. One was I dated a woman named Sarah Butterworth, and she worked in pharmaceuticals and other things. But I came up with this idea and curated something called Next Door Neighbor for Smith Magazine, right? Where AD New Orleans After the Deluge first launched.
And the PCAR Project.
And the PCAR Project, which we'll talk to Jeff Newell about. And I was getting different people to basically write and draw like stories about a next door neighbor. That was the premise.
Oh, yeah. And Sarah and I collaborated on that
There
story.
You go. Yes. That's another one.
Right.
So
but
about
you were
bees,
mention,
right?
Yes.
Okay.
The next door neighbor.
So I encouraged Sarah to write a story about a next door neighbor. So we were finally going to collaborate. And I remember taking her script, and I have the layouts and everything. And then she broke up with me, and I never finished it.
Wah, wah, wah.
That's right. So I do have an official unfinished collaboration with her. And then my current girlfriend, Jen Ferguson, who's a painter, eons ago, I want to say when I was a waiter at Nick and Eddie Restaurant, and she was dating the one of the co-owners and one of the chefs of Blue Ribbon Restaurant. Great food, awesome place, and they're all over the place. Real good people. She would sometimes come over to our restaurant, which was across the street, and hang out. And we would all just like hang out late night as waiters and
wait. So you knew
friends of
Jen back before you were dating those other women.
She's the original artist for all the Blue Ribbon restaurants.
Okay.
For the menu art, all the paintings that would hang up in the restaurants, and to this day, she still works for Blue Ribbon in that capacity. So, but the way I connected with Jen was that she was an artist, and I'm an artist. So she always had like watercolor paper and paints with her all the time, and I just draw pen and ink kind of thing, but she would like just do some like abstract coloring of stuff, like a butterfly with some background or something, and then ask me to draw on top of it, and I would draw with like my ink pen, and kind of we would do these collaborations. And then 15 years goes by, like, you know, I have not seen Jen, and then like Facebook happens, and then Sarah Butterworth breaks up with me, and I'm online, and I suddenly see Jen Ferguson is on there, like, oh, I remember Jen. She was a really cool girl. I liked her a lot, and an artist. And then we reconnected, and then I was going through files, and I found the artwork that we had collaborated on years before. So in a way, it wasn't a comic, you know, but it was an art collaboration.
And maybe there was something about the way that you were able to collaborate artistically that each gave you a little bit of a feeling of maybe there's something there.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
That's cool. I never knew the origin story of you and Jen.
Yeah,
so.
No, me and Jen had met years ago, and then 15 years go by.
Right, right.
And then, you know, and that's what can happen.
So we'll have to get her in the studio and interview the two of you and see how
that
goes.
And make it as awkward as possible. Maybe for our YouTube channel that we spark someday.
There we go.
All right. Well, I mean, was there anything else? I mean, it's a cringeworthy scene. It's an amazing scene. I love the honesty of the scene. Even if they were semi-performing because there's a camera rolling or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, we'll ask Joyce.
I'm actually surprised we were able to talk as long as this, because after we first watched that scene together, we were just like,
I was speechless.
Stupefied.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we did well. And I'm definitely curious to hear her perspective on all of that. So I guess that wraps things up. Until next time, remember, you can visit us at scenebyscenepodcast.com and Scene by Scene on Facebook. And both of those places, you can subscribe, download past episodes, get all caught up, read up on the show, check out our work, including all things Harvey Pekar, and join the discussion. And until next time, we will be discussing episode 21. Is that right?
That's right.
Man, where does the time go? This is Josh Neufeld.
And Dean Haspiel.
With Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean.